Tom Hanks has to be among my favorite actors, and Steven Spielberg has to be among my favorite directors. I've seen just about everything the two of them have made, and I'm betting that you have too. Well, they've come out with another one that sounds intriguing. It's called Bridge of Spies, and it's in your theater right now as we speak. Well, guess what? Our entire episode is devoted to the story behind Bridge of Spies, which, believe it or not, has lots and lots of constitutional stuff in it. Jeff Kahn is here to tell us all about it. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly Constitutional, and this week it's all about spies and stuff.
Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
About a year ago, my son Ben and I took a European trip, and if you're a regular listener, you probably heard some of the tape that we made over there in Britain and in Normandy. One place we did not do any recordings, and I kind of wish we had, was during the part of our trip when we were in Germany, because we went to some really cool places, and one of them was a place called Glienicker Brücke, or Glienicker Bridge, which was right on the old border between East Berlin and West Berlin, right where the wall actually sort of stopped or actually kind of went submerged because there was a river. And this bridge went across the river, and it was right on the border, and it was a convenient place to exchange spies. Now, we really enjoyed that a year ago. But little did we know at that time that two of my favorite artists, Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg, were cooperating on a film which is in theaters in the fall of 2015. It's called, appropriately enough, Bridge of Spies. And it tells a story, or at least part of the story, about the exchange of the U-2 pilot who was shot down, Francis Gary Powers, and a very mysterious fellow. Now, here to tell us about this mysterious fellow is a buddy of mine called Jeff Kahn. He's a professor of law at Southern Methodist University, and he's going to tell us all about the constitutional case that led to this exchange. And he's going to start by telling us about that mysterious Russian, a fellow who went by the name of Colonel Abel.
It wasn't actually his real name. His real name, we think, was William Fisher, because oddly enough, this Soviet spy was born in England.
Oh, for heaven's sake, really?
He was born in England to a father who had fled Tsarist Russia, who had been an assistant and supporter of Vladimir Lenin, who at a period of time was also in England. And when the family finally moved back to Russia, then the Soviet Union, Abel slowly rose through the KGB. He was apparently quite a good counterintelligence and intelligence officer, and he was posted to the United States, where he took up residence in Brooklyn as a painter. And until he made one fatal error in revealing the location of his painting studio to one of his confederates, who subsequently turned against him, he probably would have gone uncaught and we never would have been talking about him.
And when was this again? It was like in the mid-50s, right?
That's right. He was arrested in 1957, in June 1957. And that's part of the interesting story of how I even came across his name. Because If you remember, in June 2010, the world was treated to the arrest of Anna Chapman and a number of slightly less attractive-looking Russian spies who were rounded up on the eastern seaboard. And we were told that their arrest, this arrest of aspiring, was the most sensational arrest since the arrest of Colonel Abel. Mm-hmm. And when I read that, I thought, well, that's interesting, but who's Colonel Abel? So I began working on this over the course of that summer, and the article then turned into a series of lectures that I gave in Russia and Finland and elsewhere, all about this case.
What was he supposedly doing? Why did the FBI even look for him?
The concern was, and it turned out to be a very valid concern, that he was slowly attempting to obtain atomic secrets. From all over the country. He was the center point, the hub in a wheel that had spokes going out. Some people believe he had connections to the Rosenbergs, he had connections to other scientists, he had connections to other Soviet spies, and he was slowly trying to acquire atomic secrets. And in fact, the charge that he was convicted of was atomic espionage.
Oh, boy. Well, that's pretty important stuff, and it sounds like a perfect cover. So this guy is pretending to be an artist in Brooklyn, and he's got this studio. And, of course, that seems like the least likely person in the world to be a Soviet spy. So somehow the FBI gets onto his trail, and somehow, as you say, they turn another agent who then reveals something about him and where his studio is.
That's right. He actually was quite a good painter, and so he had little trouble blending in. He was, however, eventually followed around New York, and his trail was picked up and lost and picked up and lost for almost a month before the authorities decided that they wanted to make the arrest. What they didn't do, however, was seek a warrant, either from a federal judge, or at the time we didn't have magistrate judges, we had what were called United States commissioners. But they could have sought a warrant for his arrest, and they could have sought a warrant to search his hotel room and his artist studio and anything else that they wanted. But they didn't do that, and that planted the seed for the constitutional case that came later.
Yes, indeed. Of course, the Fourth Amendment, generally speaking, requires that warrants only issue upon probable cause. And as the case law has developed, generally speaking, before the police, and certainly the FBI are one type of police, before they can enter private residences or other private places, they have to go and get the warrant from an impartial magistrate, and they have to make a showing of that they've got probable cause, you know, that they've got a reason to investigate, and they didn't do that.
And that's where the case dovetails with the present day, because mm-hmm. as I learned about his case, I realized the modus operandi that the FBI decided to use is very similar to the modus operandi that the FBI and other law enforcement agents used after 9/11 in a period of great fear, a fear of terrorism and the next terrorist attack. That resonated very much with the fear in the 1950s that the Soviets would get the bomb, that Sputnik had just been launched and we were losing the space race, and that like a pile of dominoes, one country after another would fall to the communist menace.
Yeah, it was a very, very difficult time and a very, very frightful time. And the timeline basically is that the Second World War ends in 45. We have the bomb then. We have about a four-year monopoly on atomic bombs. And at this point, they're relatively unpowerful. Well, they're still very powerful, but relatively small fission weapons. The Soviets do theirs in 1949. And then both of us, that prompts our decision to get the so-called hydrogen bomb, which is 1,000 times more powerful, perhaps, followed by the Soviet Union. That happens in the 1950s, early, about 53, I think, for us. And then just a few years later, both sides are developing what are called space rockets. But, of course, the military reason is that they want to develop missiles that are capable of carrying these things to each other's territory. And of
exactly.
course, yeah, and Sputnik was in 57, so this is all happening right at, and that's what people were anxious about.
We sometimes forget just how anxiety-ridden our society was. We think back and think, well, that was a simpler time, the issues were different then, but we're thinking back with the knowledge that we won the Cold War, that things turned out well and there was no atomic explosion after the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the test bombs that affected people far away from us. So we forget that there was a real fear in society and a sense that we've got to act and not be hobbled by constitutional rules or procedures that, although would be good in a time of peace, are just going to make our efforts at keeping ourselves safer and more secure more difficult. So the mentality was very similar then as it was in the months and years after 9/11.
Absolutely. And before we leave that era, I want to emphasize once again that these were all just, it was like one major development after another. And this really made a fundamental shift in the way that the United States and the Soviet Union reacted to each other's moves, because up till about 1960, we still thought of atomic weapons as relatively rare, and we thought of them, at least in the public consciousness, as being about as powerful as the Hiroshima bomb, which everybody had seen pictures of. But these hydrogen weapons, these fusion weapons, were so much more powerful that it was about this time people started to stop even talking about civil defense, because they realized there was no longer any defense that they could get. Now that we've set the stage, so the FBI in this environment decides, hey, we're just investigating a spy. We don't need no stinking warrant.
Well, they were slightly more sophisticated than that, but not by much. What they decided to do was just what was decided to do after 9/11. Mm-hmm. Colonel Abel is not a United States citizen, and the manner in which he arrived into the United States was not, shall we say, a completely lawful manner. He used forged documents. He was here in a very illegal capacity. So there was every power and every resource to arrest him on what was then called an administrative immigration warrant and deport him after a short hearing that would establish that indeed he wasn't here lawfully.
Isn't that interesting? Before we leave that, and I know we're not going to talk about immigration law, but that's something I didn't know either. Now, normally speaking, when you hear about spies, they're you know, pretending to be something else. They're Soviet diplomats.
Right. Those are what you would call, for lack of a better term, legal spies.
Right.
But an illegal spy, and Anna Chapman and her crew were illegal spies, are people pretending to be ordinary, everyday citizens, like painters with studios in Brooklyn, when in reality they are spying for a foreign government. And that's a crime that you'll find in Title 18 of the United States Code.
Sure, absolutely. And in fact, of course, at this stage, I have to ask you the obligatory question. This is kind of like that cable series, The Americans, right?
Well, I'm afraid you've got me at a loss because I haven't seen the series, but I've heard of it, and it's very much like that, yes.
Yeah, so the premise there is that you've got these people who are here illegally. They're so-called deep cover agents, and they're pretending to be an everyday American family. So, okay, now I'm oriented. That's what this guy's doing. FBI should have perhaps, and I guess we'll talk more about this in a moment, gotten some sort of administrative warrant, because what they were really dealing with was a person who might be called an undocumented alien.
And this is where it got a little confusing, because the FBI, to give them their credit, they felt that they were really in a desperate spot. They keep losing this guy. He's a marvelous spy. He could enter a department store wearing a hat with a white band, and he would leave the department store wearing a hat with a black band and just slip right under their noses. The techniques he used were just really marvelous, and they were afraid of losing him perhaps forever. Now they've got their quarry. They want to turn him, and they've got two big problems, or at least they perceive two big problems. The first problem is the subordinate, the confederate of Abel's that they had managed to turn and who had revealed his initial location, refuses to testify. So they fear that without that testimony, maybe they don't have probable cause. I dispute that in the article, but that was one fear. I think what was really motivating this, though, was the second concern. And the second concern is, if we get a warrant from a magistrate, that means that after the arrest, we're going to have to return to that magistrate where we're going to have a short hearing. And that's going to mean publicity. And that publicity means that we're not going to be able to use Abel as a double agent.
I see. So we'd busted in, we'd arrested Abel, we wanted to turn him, and the FBI had a legitimate concern that if they did follow established procedures for so-called illegal aliens, that they would then find themselves in the front page of the New York Times, and then he's no longer good as a counter-spy.
Well, if they follow the procedure for criminal law to make a criminal arrest, that's exactly right. So what they decided to do was bring in the INS, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, which at the time was a component of the Department of Justice, just like the FBI. So you could think of these as two hands from the same administrative agency body. Mm-hmm. The FBI called the INS and told them what they wanted to do. The FBI agents, along with INS agents, then together went to the Hotel Latham in Manhattan, where Colonel Abel was sleeping, and the FBI busted in the door. They knocked, Abel opened, and then, according to the testimony of the FBI agents, they pushed their way in, started addressing him as Colonel to make clear that they knew who he was, and encouraged him to come clean. When they realized he wasn't going to turn immediately, the FBI walked out, waited outside the door, and the INS agents walked in with their administrative immigration warrant, a warrant that wouldn't require any public hearing. They then searched the room, searched him, questioned him for a while, and then told him, well, we're going to take you now to the immigration authorities and begin the deportation process. That's not what happened, but I have to tell you one more thing that did in the interim. As soon as the INS walked out, and I should say Abel paid his bill at the hotel, the FBI then marched back in a second time, scouring the hotel for evidence. In fact, they found all the evidence of espionage. They found a hollowed-out nickel, which could contain a secret-coded paper. They found the secret-coded paper. They found a cipher book hidden in a hollowed-out pencil. It was really an extraordinary find. They really did catch him in flagrante delicto.
Wow, I want to get me one of those hollowed-out nickels.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and if today's episode sounds like a spy thriller to you, it's because it is. I'm speaking with Jeff Kahn, a law professor at Southern Methodist University, who's written all about the constitutional issues, in fact, the constitutional case in front of the Supreme Court that led up to the incidents that are now portrayed in the Steven Spielberg film Bridge of Spies. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, then we'll come back and we'll speak some more with Jeff Kahn, so stick around. Doug Smith, how the heck are you today?
I'm doing great.
You're not wearing a tie, though. I'm wearing a tie, and you're not wearing a tie.
Yes, I'm untied, untethered.
You're untethered, not to say unhinged.
But you also have a camel coat, which
I have a camel haircut. I'm looking pretty spiffy today.
It's impressive, I have to tell you. Never having been to the Middle East. I've never been.
Jen Howell from Montpelier is here with me. I think the camel haircoat looks good, don't you? She's giving me the thumbs up. Mark, you think that looks good?
Awesome.
Tremendous. Okay. Do you have a quiz for us?
I do. I've got a great quiz.
A great quiz. Mm-hmm. It has to do with clothing, does it?
Mm-hmm. It actually does have to do with clothing.
Now we don't have to cut all that stuff we were just talking about because it's relevant, you see.
Everything's relevant. It's the Constitution.
Okay. Do we have someone on the line?
Yes, sir. This is Michael from Whitesburg, Kentucky.
So I know where Whitesburg is, but I don't know that I've ever actually been through it. I understand it's a very nice place. And in fact, it's tweaking my memory. We did a show some time ago on smallpox and on the constitutional aspects of vaccination, you know, whether people have a right to refuse. Wasn't Whitesburg one of the big areas where people had to be forced at gunpoint to get vaccinated about 100 years ago?
You know, that sounds very interesting, but I'm not sure.
Okay, well, I just slandered your hometown for no reason. No, I think it was. I think Whitesburg, Kentucky was one of the places I've read about where literally the police were coming out. It was early 20th century, and people didn't want to get vaccinated, and so then they were forced to do so at gunpoint, and that's a huge constitutional liberty issue. But I think I'm digressing a bit here, Doug. I'm sorry.
No. I mean, who doesn't love the pox?
Indeed. Well, what's your quiz about?
All right, Michael, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, I'm going to read a question. I'm going to give you four choices. Here we go. What part of the U.S. Constitution is not often used in arguments around school fashion cases? What part of the U.S. Constitution is not often used in arguments around school fashion cases?
So these are fashion, like clothing
cases.
This
is like what kids can wear to clothes and what they can. Okay, so always controversial.
Yeah.
Is it A, violation of students' First Amendment rights to freedom of expression? Is it B, violations of students' First Amendment rights to freely practice religion? C, violation of parents' 14th Amendment liberty in rearing their children? Or is it D, Article 3, Section 9, barring the court from playing fashion police while wearing those drab black robes?
Michael, do you have an idea of which of those is not typically used in those cases?
Well, I think I can see the First Amendment arguments being used. Can you repeat answer D for me?
Sure. Answer D is Article 3, Section 9, very famous part of the Constitution, barring the court from playing fashion police, given they're wearing those drab black robes?
Well, I'm not familiar with Article 3, Section 9. Suppose I should be. So I think I'm going to go with D.
Doug?
You are correct.
Okay, awesome.
I'm pulling out my copy of the Constitution here because, yeah, I seem to recall only three sections in Article 3, so you are way, way off.
Michael, you did a great job with that. That was a stretch, I know. You know, this is a great one, actually, because,
it is.
You know, we're into the school year now, and there's actually been some cases recently.
There have been. In fact, quite nearby, I think, in Christiansburg, Virginia.
In Montgomery County, that's right, where kids, originally it was about them having stickers on their cars.
Right.
And there was this threat of suspension.
Yep.
And then in protest, they all start wearing, what do we call it? Do we call it the rebel flag, the Confederate flag?
Confederate battle flag, typically.
The
stars and bars,
flag.
Yeah.
And, it's interesting because in the past, the courts have generally, not always, but generally sided with the school systems here. But Montgomery County seems to be getting a little far out of itself. And to be honest with you, I'm not sure that the Supreme Court has taken this issue of fashion in schools up. Clearly, they have stirred a hornet's nest.
Indeed, they have. And indeed, just to put it back in the context of the quiz, all three of those first choices, A, the free speech, B, the freedom of religion, or C, even a parent's fundamental right to rear their children the way they wish. All of those are implicated when a child wears something to school, or they can be. I mean, certainly anything you wear is part of your self-expression. If it has a religious aspect, then it could be free exercise of religion. And then, of course, parents often have something to say about what their kids wear, and maybe parents have given them a certain article of clothing. Maybe the parent wants them to display the Confederate battle flag. And then the school says no, so the parents' rights are implicated as well. So all of A, B, and C are highly relevant in these sorts of cases. But the general rule is difficult to state because there are two leading cases on this. One is the Tinker case from the late 1960s, the black armband case, where Mary Beth Tinker, whom we've also interviewed in an episode, was suspended for wearing her black armband protesting the Vietnam War, and then famously went all the way to the Supreme Court, which said children do not leave their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse gate. So, yay, they've got free expression rights. But then the Hazelwood case, about 20 years later in the 1980s, said, except schools have the power to regulate children's speech if it means keeping an orderly school system that's not disrupted, so the educational process is not disrupted, and certainly so that the children are not endangered. I think the school officials, I agree with you, Doug, I think they're starting to push a little bit pretty hard on that, and I think maybe some courts are going to start clarifying that there still is some free expression right there.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, it really will always come down to the court itself, and it has to make its way up.
Right.
Because ultimately, you don't suspend your rights of expression or religion at the door. And yet, in the 80s, when, is it the Hazelwood?
Yeah, Hazelwood case, right.
Came up, you know, we saw the rise of really gangs at that stage.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a reaction to this
gang. It was, and gangs were wearing certain colors.
And earrings, so if I remember, it was about earrings and colors, yeah.
It's interesting you say the court's composition is important because I believe one of the nine justices, Clarence Thomas, has come out and very explicitly said children have no rights in school. We tell them what to do and they do it. Okay. Well, I don't think he supports the Tinker decision. I think he's very much a Hazelwood guy to the nth degree. And so I think it's time to wrap up. But congratulations, Michael. You get a Constitution from James Madison's Montpelier. You get a T-shirt. So send us an email at ywc@montpelier.org. And we will send those items to you post-haste.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Stuart and Doug. I love listening to the show.
Thanks very much. And Doug, thank you.
Hey, thanks, Stuart. It's the Constitution. We read it for the articles.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to continue my conversation with Jeff Kahn, a law professor at Southern Methodist University, who's telling me all about the constitutional background to the current movie by Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks called Bridge of Spies. Just before the break, Jeff was telling me about the capture by the FBI of the mysterious Colonel Abel. It seems that Colonel Abel was caught red-handed with things like hollowed-out pencils and hollowed-out nickels and other cool spy stuff.
Well, then what happened is not what would have happened with an ordinary immigration warrant. Ordinarily, what would have happened would have been a presentment before an immigration commissioner, either immediately or a short time later. And the immigration administrative hearing would have taken place at 70 Columbus Circle in New York City. Mm-hmm. What actually happened, though, and this is what leads me to conclude that what was really motivating this was a desire to turn him as a double agent secretly. He wasn't brought to Columbus Circle. He was brought to Newark, where a plane, a private plane, was waiting that took him to McAllen, Texas, 2,000 miles away. And in McAllen, Texas, he sat, this is in June 1957, he sat for 7 weeks, 49 days, where he was aggressively interrogated without a lawyer, except for the brief period when they decided, well, we better do that deportation hearing and lock that in. Mm-hmm. Brought in a lawyer, determined that he was deportable and should be deported, that he was not entitled to be in the United States, and then they continued with a conveyor belt series of interrogations to try to break him, to try to turn him into an agent for the United States against his Soviet senders. But Abel, either because of loyalty or because of training or because of courage or something else, absolutely refused to speak. He was what every defense attorney would say is the model arrestee, because he would not say a word other than essentially name, rank, and serial number.
Okay, but he did effectively then admit that he was Colonel Abel.
Well, he gave his name as Abel, mm-hmm. which didn't jive with his immigration papers. But he wouldn't say anything about what he was doing, who he was meeting with. He would not concede that he was a spy. He essentially just sat stock still and silent. Mm-hmm. And the affidavits of the FBI agents read almost with a mix of frustration and admiration. They had never experienced someone like this. Mm-hmm. Here's someone who is so high up, the chief, if you will, of North American espionage for the Soviet Union, a master coup if they could turn him, and he will not speak. Well, now
he sounds like somebody who's really dedicated. I mean, obviously, based on what you said, but also, I mean, my understanding is that the Soviet Union in the 1950s was a pretty bleak place, and he'd had a pretty good deep taste of 1950s American life. I mean, he'd been in New York City. You could almost imagine him being tempted by the freedoms of the United States, but it sounds like he wasn't, or at least he resisted whatever temptations he felt.
Well, it's hard to know what was going through his mind. We know that his father was a zealous supporter of Lenin and an mm-hmm. advocate of communism. We know that he was highly trained. We also know that he had a wife and child in the Soviet Union.
Oh, there's your motivation then, yeah.
And that was really, I think, the insurance that the Soviets had that he's not going to turn very easily. But, of course, yeah. In the United States, we didn't know this at the time. Well, now the FBI realizes that they've misjudged their quarry. And so they decided, and this is where the constitutional elements come back in, well, we've got all this evidence of atomic espionage. The FBI has accomplished a masterful arrest and has rounded up several members of this espionage team. Now we're going to try him in federal district court in the Eastern District of New York in Brooklyn for atomic espionage.
And this is an open trial.
This is an open trial.
Okay, so they've given up entirely, and now it's going to be in the front page of the New York Times. Okay.
Yes, because if you can't turn him into a double agent, at least the agency can get the credit for catching this spy.
Very important for them, sure.
And that's where Jim Donovan comes into the picture, his lawyer, because Abel, again, shows that he's a very smart guy. When he's brought before Judge Byers in the Eastern District in Brooklyn, he didn't ask for a lawyer to be appointed by the court. He asked for the court to consult the bar about finding appropriate legal counsel. That mm-hmm. meant, on the record, that he was implying that the judge himself might not be trusted to come up with a proper attorney for his defense on his own. And the judge, although a little irked by the suggestion implicit in the request, followed Abel's request, and the bar committee met and asked Jim Donovan, a 41-year-old at the time, rising star of the New York bar, if he would take the case.
Now, before we go on, you're exactly right. That is very unusual. Typically, court-appointed counsel is something that the judge will do himself or herself. And in fact, the stories are legion among lawyers of simply being in the wrong courtroom at the wrong time and finding themselves suddenly appointed to represent somebody in a criminal case.
Right. And for a politician or a rising politician like Jim Donovan, this is not a very lucrative assignment. First of all, it was going to take an awful lot of time. Mm-hmm. Second of all, it was unlikely he was going to earn any money from it. And he very politically astutely determined that even if he could acquire some money, the court selling the – well, perhaps not selling, but acquiring the assets from the painter's studio was willing to provide $10,000 for the defense. Donovan refused it all and donated it to charity, knowing that accepting money from a Soviet spy was not a good political move. He is also roundly vilified in the papers in much the same way that a Defense Department official after 9/11 vilified lawyers who took pro bono the habeas cases of Guantanamo detainees, right, saying, yes, it's a noble tradition of the bar to accept for the benefit of the public the defense of people who cannot afford a defense on their own. But that doesn't mean that you have to choose to defend any of these people. Mm-hmm. That was just the insinuation and the attack of this Defense Department official after 9/11, and it was the same attack that Donovan exposed himself to, not something that a person aspiring to political office wants to have to defend against.
What were his political views at this stage? Was he a conservative fellow or a more liberal fellow?
Well, it's hard for me to translate that into the politics of today, but like most members of our profession, I'd say he was conservative with a small c. He believed in institutions. He believed in structures of government. He was definitely someone who had succeeded in life by benefiting from those established structures. He was a very accomplished private lawyer in New York City, and although he lost a Senate run for a run for the United States Senate years afterwards, he did go on to not immodest fame as a public figure. He was
well. Before we get there, let's not give away the end of the story yet. But no, that's all right. But so he's a guy who really is aspiring to this. And of course, at this time, we're in the middle of what's sometimes called the Second Red Scare. The first one having been around the time of the Bolshevik Revolution. And so this was very similar, as you point out, to representing someone who's an accused Islamic terrorist today. These are not popular people.
Right. All of these things resonated with me as I was beginning the research with the article. It was, as Yogi Berra said, deja vu all over again. Mm-hmm. Almost the same words, almost the same complaints about process, the insistence that exceptional times require exceptional measures, forgetting that the last time we did that, we really didn't need to after all.
Indeed. What did Harry Truman once say? The only thing new in the world is the history you don't know.
Well, exactly right. And on a very unfortunate reference that continues to pop up in the legal academic writing that I read is a reference to a Nazi legal a theoretician named Schmidt, who once said, "Sovereign is he who can make the exception." When someone is able to say an emergency is occurring and therefore the usual rules don't apply, in Justice Jackson's terms, that tends to kindle emergencies, and that's a very dangerous world to live in.
All right. Well, let's go back to 1957 or thereabouts, and Donovan has now been appointed, I'm guessing, to some extent against his will.
Well, he thought about it for quite a while and ultimately decided to take the case, and I think that shows that this is someone who really did believe in the nobler aspects of our profession. He really did believe that this was a pro bono case, and this isn't someone who was sympathetic to Abel's views or to communism in general. He had been a prosecutor at Nuremberg. He had helped to establish and work in the OSS, although he was no relation of Wild Bill Donovan. Mm-hmm. And he was a commissioned naval reservist. So he made pellucidly clear to Abel that I will do my duty by you as your attorney. But that's where my duty ends. I'm also a United States citizen, and he took that status very, very seriously.
It sounds like he did. All right. So now he's on the case.
He's on the case, and he is desperate to find a way to exclude the evidence that was obtained in the Hotel Latham. Remember, there is very incriminating physical evidence in this case, in addition to the testimony from a former Confederate and others that we can get to in a little bit. But there's a hollowed-out nickel. There's a cipher pad. There are secret notes. There are all these things of espionage. And Donovan's motion is what brought him to the Supreme Court. He moved Judge Byers to suppress that evidence as unlawfully acquired.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Jeff Kahn, a law professor from Southern Methodist University, who's telling me all about the constitutional case that is the background for the current Steven Spielberg, Tom Hanks movie, Bridge of Spies. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll come back and finish our discussion with Jeff Kahn. Stick around.
Pessimists who believe that the history of America is one long, woeful tale of inexorable decline, it should be heartening to learn that, in many respects, the manner of holding elections has unquestionably improved since Madison's day. In that time, candidates were in the practice not only of publicly offering their services, Madison-related, but of soliciting the votes of the people and giving them treats, particularly of intoxicating drinks. Madison tried to set a better example. Patriotic fervor ran high in Virginia's election of 1777, and James Madison thought that the people would welcome a more chaste mode of conducting elections. He therefore refused to bribe voters with the corrupting influence of spirituous liquors and other treats on election day. It was a noble experiment, but it was also the only popular election that Madison ever lost. With the Madison Minute, I'm Jen Patia Howell.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish up my conversation with Southern Methodist University law professor Jeff Kahn. He's telling us all about the constitutional case behind the movie Bridge of Spies, and it turns out that the Tom Hanks character, Attorney James Donovan, took it all the way to the Supreme Court on the question of whether certain evidence should be suppressed.
Okay, now before we leave the evidence, now we've got ciphers and things, and I'm guessing Abel didn't translate them since he wasn't talking. I mean, did it really actually show, if this evidence had remained in, did it really actually show that what was in those ciphers had to do with atomic secrets?
Well, I'm not quite sure that they had gotten so far as to decipher the ciphered material, although I think that that's probably likely.
Okay.
But what it did show was that he was communicating with the Soviet Union, and
okay.
That's all that would have been needed for the conviction. The atomic part of it could have been established by the testimony of some of his confederates and the other people.
Okay, so this is damning evidence, and so that's why Donovan zeroes in on it. So he gets the evidence out, he gets this guy off. If the evidence stays in, the guy's going in the slammer, and in fact, atomic secrets, I think that carried a death penalty, didn't it? Stealing those?
It certainly did.
And were they seeking the death penalty?
Well, they were, and that not to give the game away, but that's the second great thing that he did for.
Okay, hold on. Let's not give it away then. Okay, let's go with the evidence. He seeks to get it suppressed, and let's talk about that issue then.
His argument was very clear, and he presented it this way. He said, at the moment that the FBI decided that they wanted to detain Abel, they had a very serious choice, because the Justice Department then, just as now, was wearing two hats. It was wearing a law enforcement hat and it was wearing a national security hat. If the FBI agents chose to bust into that room wearing the intelligence hat, as they were fully entitled to do, Donovan argued, then the choice was to try to turn him, and if they succeeded, great, but if they didn't, their only recourse was to deport him. If, however, they chose to go in with the law enforcement hat, then they had to follow the constitutional requirements for proper law enforcement. They would have to have either obtained a warrant, or if not a warrant, then to have some exception satisfied. And they chose not to do any of those things. Having made that choice at the moment of detention, his argument concluded, the FBI couldn't change its mind when their efforts to turn Abel had failed.
Hey, now that's the, I think you've talked about, I'm anticipating here, that that's the key decision, that's the key thing to think about this entire case. Two tracks. One of them, your intelligence, don't need no stinking warrant, but the only thing you can do is basically try to turn the guy or whatever and send him home if you don't. But track number two, if you're actually going to try him, then you got to treat him like any other criminal defendant.
Right. Exactly right.
Okay. At least that's the argument that Donovan was making. Okay. Now we've established that. Let's go on, please.
Sure. Well, the case was argued twice before the Supreme Court, which itself is unusual. And the probable reason, I think, is established by the extended time that the parties were given for the second oral argument. Normally, parties are given about 30 minutes before the court to make their case. In this case, each was given 90 minutes. So that's quite a lot of time. The court was sharply divided. In the end, the opinion was 5-4. It was written by Justice Frankfurter, and it was written in the narrowest terms possible. Rather than decide that the warrant was needed or not needed, rather than come to some conclusion about whether there was some pretextual use of one power over another, Justice Frankfurter essentially concluded that it wasn't proper for the Supreme Court to assess the determination of good faith that had been made both by the district court and by the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit about the use of these different mechanisms.
Let me pause here. That is an extraordinarily narrow holding.
That's a very narrow holding.
And I'm guessing here that implicit in that holding is that was what they thought of as the key, that as long as the FBI was acting in good faith, that got them off the hook?
Well, this was certainly not something that Donovan believed. Justice Frankfurter made a crucial distinction, and this gets back to your comment about the first Red Scare, because during the Palmer raids, which were a series of FBI raids during the terrified years after the Russian Revolution, raids in the United States to round up the usual suspects, the Department of Labor was sometimes used to make arrests in some of the same ways that the INS was used in the Abel case or the INS was used in post 9/11 worlds. In those cases, Justice Frankfurter, then a lawyer, not a Supreme Court justice, argued that the Department of Labor couldn't be used as the cat's paw of the Department of Justice.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, Frankfurter said, the Department of Justice isn't using some other agency or department. Both the FBI and the INS are two components within the same department.
Oh my gosh. We'll talk about your splitting hairs. Excuse me.
Well, actually, this resonates with an issue that was right before the 9/11 Commission. Mm-hmm. Because if you'll remember, one of the sharpest criticisms of the way we were trying to balance security and liberty before 9/11 was that we had established a wall between the law enforcement activities of the federal government and the intelligence gathering activities. And that wall was impermeable. That's really what Donovan was arguing in this case, that having made that choice to go on one side of the wall or the other, then you can't vault back over when you don't get the outcome you want. Well, the 9/11 Commission helped to tear down that wall, saying it was too high and it was too impermeable. And Justice Frankfurter's view in this case was, we can rely on the good faith of officials that has already been established by the district court and the Court of Appeals to use their separate authorities in the same department in an appropriate fashion. And we're not going to look behind the objective legality, formal though it may be, to use an administrative immigration warrant for the subjective pretextual purpose of trying to evade publicity and all the other liberty-preserving aspects of a public hearing and having to go to a neutral magistrate.
So this all boils down to what we commonly call deference. We're simply not going to question what the agency did here because these are the guys who have to make these decisions every day, and we're going to assume that they're at least, we're going to have some sort of supposition to begin with that they are acting in good faith.
Well, Justice Frankfurter wanted it both ways. He wanted to cobble together this narrow majority and not decide in a case, as he put it, or I think it was the Second Circuit, actually, that fairly shrieks the guilt of Colonel Abel. They didn't really want to decide such a big issue in this case. But Justice Douglas and Justice Brennan, two of the more liberal members of the Supreme Court at the time, called Frankfurter on just this, saying this case has nothing to do with good faith. Nobody is contesting the good faith of the FBI agents or the immigration agents that they were doing what they were what they actually did for reasons of bad faith. The FBI used the INS. The INS was happy to be used by the FBI. They were very rigidly adhering to the formal limits of their power. Good faith, Douglas and Brennan said, have nothing to do with it. The real issue in this case is whether such a formal distinction should be allowed to occur when, for all practical purposes, you are eviscerating the real objectives of the Fourth Amendment, which is to provide the protections of publicity and openness and transparency to the accused.
Good grief. All right, well, let's continue with the saga. So Donovan takes it to the court, and by a one-vote margin, he loses.
He loses by one vote margin after two oral arguments. You really can't come any closer than that. And meantime, Abel has been sitting in prison. Mm-hmm. Now, as you had said earlier, this was a capital offense, atomic espionage. And Donovan managed to save Abel's life with this argument. Even if the court has concluded that my motion should be denied, that the accused is guilty and is properly sentenced, don't sentence him to death for the very national security reasons that have brought him to court in the first place. Namely, someday we might need to get one of our own back from the Soviet Union.
Now hold off. That is, had the lower court sentenced him to death?
No, he hadn't been sentenced to death, but he was not sentenced to death because James Donovan had argued that his life ought to be spared and he should just have what he got, which was a 30-year prison sentence.
Okay, so that's where he was, but the arguments he'd been making since the district court then had been that don't sentence him to death because we might need him as a pawn, as a bargaining chip at some point.
Right, right.
That's a remarkably ingenious argument.
Well, maybe this reflects Donovan's very practical experience in intelligence and thinking as a not just a U.S. citizen, but as a commissioned naval officer and someone with experience from the Second World War. He was thinking very prospectively. Mm-hmm. He was also thinking about the best needs of his client, which are, as any capital defense attorney will tell you, served by keeping your client alive day after day after day.
Mm-hmm. That's a remarkable confluence of the national interest and the interests of his client, and that was, again, an ingenious argument. So kudos to Donovan, and he gets his guy off. His guy is not put in the chair.
He's not put into the chair. He's put into prison where he continues to paint, where he requests books on mathematics. Abel was a very intelligent, intellectual sort of guy and made use of his time as best he could. A few years later, the Supreme Court case having come down in 1960, Francis Gary Powers, a pilot of a high-altitude U-2 reconnaissance plane, is shot down over the Soviet Union and now is in the hands of the enemy.
And he's given a great big trial over there.
Yes, and this was another one of the resonances that interested me in the case. As I had said before, I have a background in Russian law and politics, and one of the arguments made during Abel's trial in the United States was he would not have gotten as fair a trial in the Soviet Union as he got in the United States, that U.S. justice is better than Russian justice. And certainly in 1960 that was true.
We've now had the show trial of under Khrushchev, of Francis Gary Powers. That's the inquisitorial model, and I'm guessing that Powers was convicted.
Oh, yes. And
in the Soviet Union. And so now we've got two convictions and two spies, one of them, you know, on the ground in sort of traditional cloak and dagger fashion. That's, of course, Colonel Abel. And then Gary Powers, who represents sort of the new wave of, you know, going up and photographing people from above. But now we've got two high profile spies. And what are we going to do about him?
So Donovan enters the scene again, and this time it's as a private citizen trying to orchestrate the trade of our man for theirs. And this is what gives Steven Spielberg's movie its name, Bridge of Spies, because mm-hmm. the exchange of Colonel Abel for Francis Gary Powers takes place on the Gleinecke Bridge, which is a bridge that connects part of Berlin with Potsdam. And at the center of that bridge on a snowy February night, James Donovan walked out with his client, and Donovan's counterpart walked out with Francis Gary Powers, and the exchange of spies was made.
And that's a very dramatic conclusion to all of this, and that was done more than one time at this particular location, wasn't it?
Well, I think that the bridge developed a certain utility that in the height of the Cold War, when it was sometimes so difficult for the two sides to communicate, it provided a sort of neutral position for exchanges.
Yeah, it's actually sort of a natural place for it. In fact, some people forget, or maybe have never really thought about it, that although of course East and West Germany share a common border, that's basically a 1,000-mile-long north-south border. The Berlin, of course, is an island, and so the Berlin Wall itself was more or less a circle encircling the British and the French and the American sectors. And at the southwest sector of that particular circle, you've got lots of lakes and lots of streams, and the Gleinecke Bridge was just right across one of those things. In fact, it was right near two very significant places. One of them, of course, was Potsdam, which is where Truman and Stalin and Churchill had their famous conference at the end of the war. And then on the other side was Wannsee, which, of course, is infamous as the place where the SS and the Gestapo all got together and planned the final solution of the Jewish problem, as they called it. And in that history-crammed area, that part of Berlin, this wall basically went right down the middle of the river, and that is where the bridge is, and that was in some sense a perfect spot for everybody to come out on this bridge, and everybody could see everybody else. And it was also, I think, not a particularly busy crossing. It wasn't like Checkpoint Charlie, so they could just kind of go down there and do these things and do them openly for themselves, but not for the wider public.
Right. And although my article is called The Case of Colonel Abel, and like any author, I'm delighted to be read by as many as possible, it appeared in the Journal of National Security Law and Policy. I wanted to recommend the book that James Donovan wrote. And it's really an extraordinary lawyer's diary. He was a diarist, and he kept good notes, and it reads in diary form from before his arrival on the scene to long after the case was over. And the ultimate denouement of the exchange on the bridge takes place. The book, which is, I think, just been reissued, mm-hmm. is called Strangers on a Bridge, The Case of Colonel Abel. Strangers on a Bridge, which is an interesting title with multiple meanings, because, of course, Abel did not know Powers. But in a sense, Donovan didn't really know Abel. It wasn't his real name. Mm-hmm. The two were really far opposed in their politics and in their lives, in the trajectory their lives had taken before the case as well as afterwards. Mm-hmm. Abel died a rather lonely figure in the Soviet Union. He certainly could never be sent out into the field again. And so there isn't all that much use for a spy once you are... once your cover is blown. And so Abel leads an increasingly lonely and despondent life back in the Soviet Union. Donovan goes on to try to become a senator from the state of New York. He didn't succeed, but he was involved in trying to establish prisoner exchanges in Cuba. He was the president of the Pratt Institute, I believe. He was on the Board of Education in New York. And continued to be a public servant until he died at the too young age of 53 in 1970.
Yeah, that is rather young. You're younger than I am right now, so he seems very young to die. What did he die of? Do you know?
I think it was a heart attack.
Oh, I guess he was just working too hard.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Jeff Kahn for telling us about all the constitutional stuff behind that movie by Steven Spielberg, Bridge of Spies. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our Madison Minute is by Jen Patia Howell. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.